に。
大家好，这里是北京外语广播正在播出的大学生英语在线 Question of the Day， 我是米歇尔米歇尔。今天我们请到的嘉宾依然是壮壮老师。
That's right, it's me again. 那今天我们选的这一段呢，这个 speaker is by the name of Amy Tan 啊，这个听这个名字就有点像亚洲人，她长得也是亚洲的样子，但是英文说的还是非常的漂亮。
嗯，
啊，这个 Amy Tan 是何许人也呢？啊 ，She is a novelist， 写小说的。他这个题目是 Where does creativity hide? 他呢挺有意思的，这个 novelist Amy Tan digs deep into the creative process,、looking for hints of how hers evolved. 他是一个其实是挺有方法的、挺有章法的过程，发现自己的这个创造性。我觉得哈，就是你觉得自己是什么情况下会特别有这个创造性呢？
有一个 deadline 的时候。
就有创造性
了，必须得出个什么东西的时候，
真的、那你就是 deadline driven、creativity。 我觉得这个创造性对于我来讲呢，就是特别放松的情况下、特别有创造性。比如说你即使是在工作的状态下，就是思想特别放松的时候，往往就会想出好多的奇思妙想的点子。
嗯，
还有一些人呢，比如说这个 improvise 的这些艺术家，他也是很有创造性的，就是他的创造性就完全是即兴的，荧光灯探照灯
一闪，眼睛一瞎
就创造出来了一个虾米。好，现在我们就听一下这一段。
The value of nothing, out of nothing comes something. That was an essay that I wrote when I was 11 years old and I got a B+. But I'm going to talk about nothing out of something and how we create. And I'm going to try and do that within the 18-minute time span that we were told to stay within and to follow the Ten Commandments that is actually、something that creates a near-death experience, but near-death is good for creativity. Okay. So I also want to explain, because Dave Eggers said he was going to heckle me if I said anything that was a lie or not true to universal creativity. And I've done it this way for half the audience who is scientific. When I say we, I don't mean you necessarily. I mean me and my right brain, my left brain, and the one that's in between that is the sensor and tells me what I'm saying is wrong. And I'm going to do that also by looking at what I think is part of my creative process, which includes a number of things that happen. Actually, the nothing started even earlier than the moment in which I'm creating something new. And that includes, nature and nurture and what I refer to as nightmares. Now, in the nature area, we, look at whether or not we are innately, equipped with something perhaps in our brain, some abnormal chromosome that causes this muse-like effect. Some people would say that we're born with it in some other means, and others, like my mother, would say that I get my material from past lives. Some people would also say that creativity may be a function of、some other neurological quirk and、the Van Gogh syndrome, that you have a little bit of, you know, psychosis or depression. I do have to say, somebody I read recently that Van Gogh wasn't really、necessarily psychotic, that he might have had temporal lobe seizures and that might have caused this spurt of creativity. And I suppose it does something in some part of your brain. And I will mention that I actually developed temporal lobe seizures a number of years ago, but it was during the time I was writing my last book, and some people say that book is quite different. I think that part of it also begins with a sense of identity crisis. You know, who am I? Why am I this particular person? Why am I not black like everybody else? And sometimes you're equipped with skills, but they may not be the kind of skills that enable creativity. I used to draw. I thought I would be an artist, and I had a miniature poodle. And it wasn't bad, but it wasn't really creative, because all I could really do was represent in a very one-on-one way. And I have a sense that I probably copied this from a book. And then I also wasn't really shining in a certain area that I wanted to be. you know, you look at those scores and it wasn't bad, but it was not certainly predictive that I would one day make my living out of the artful arrangement of words. Also, one of the principles of creativity is to have a little childhood trauma. And I had the usual kind that I think a lot of people had, and that is that, you know, I had expectations placed on me. That figure right there, by the way, figure right there was a toy given to me when I was but 9 years old, and it was to help me become a doctor from a very early age. I have some ones that were long-lasting from the age of 5 to 15. This was supposed to be my side occupation, and it led to a sense of failure. But actually, there was something quite real in my life that happened when I was about 14, and it was discovered that my brother in 1967 and then my father 6 months later had brain tumors. And my mother believed that something had gone wrong and she was going to find out what it was and she was going to fix it. My father was a Baptist minister and he believed in miracles and that God's will would take care of that. But of course they ended up dying 6 months apart. And after that my mother believed that it was fate or curses. She went looking through all the reasons in the universe why this would have happened. Everything except randomness. She did not believe in randomness. There was a reason for everything. And one of the reasons she thought was that her mother, who had died when she was very young, was angry at her. And so I had this notion of death all around me because my mother also believed that I would be next and she would be next. And when you are faced with the prospect of death very soon, you begin to think very much about everything. You become very creative in a survival sense. And this then led to my big questions, and they're the same ones that I have today. And they are, why do things happen? And how do things happen? And the one my mother asked, how do I make things happen? It's a wonderful way to look at these questions when you write a story, because after all, in that framework between page one and 300, you have to answer this question of why things happen, how things happen, in what order they happen, what are the influences, how do I as the narrator, as the writer, also influence that. And it's also one that I think many of our scientists have been asking. It's a kind of cosmology, and I have to develop a cosmology of my own universe as the creator of that universe. And you see there are a lot of there's a lot of back and forth in trying to make that happen, trying to figure it out, years and years oftentimes. So when I look at creativity, I also think that it is this sense or this inability to repress my looking at associations in practically anything in life. And I got a lot of them during what's been going on throughout this conference, almost everything that's been going on. And so I'm going to use as the metaphor this association, quantum mechanics, which I really don't understand, but I'm still going to use it as the process for explaining how it is the metaphor. So, in quantum mechanics, of course, you have dark energy and dark matter. And it's the same thing in looking at these questions of how things happen. There's a lot of unknown, and you often don't know what it is except by its absence. But when you make those associations, you want them to come together in a kind of synergy in the story, and what you're finding is what matters, the meaning. And that's what I look for in my work, a personal meaning. There is also the uncertainty principle, which is part of quantum mechanics, as I understand it. And this happens constantly in the writing. And there's a terrible and dreaded observer effect in which you're looking for something and, you know, things are happening simultaneously and you're looking at it in a different way. And you're trying to really look for the about answer. What is the story about? And if you try too hard, then you will only write the about. You won't discover anything. And what you were supposed to find, what you hoped to find in some serendipitous way, is no longer there. Now, I don't want to ignore the other side of what happens in our universe like many of our scientists have, and so I am going to just throw in string theory here and just say that creative people are multidimensional, and there are 11 levels, I think, of anxiety, and they all operate at the same time. There is also a big question of ambiguity, and I would link that to something called the cosmological constant. You don't know what is operating, but something is operating there. And ambiguity to me is very uncomfortable in my life, and I have it. Moral ambiguity. It is constantly there. And just as an example, this is one that recently came to me. It was something I read in an editorial by a woman who was talking about the war in Iraq. And she said, save a man from drowning, you are responsible to him for life. A very famous Chinese saying, she said, and that means that because we went into Iraq, we should stay there until things were solved, you know, maybe even 100 years. So there was another one that that I came across, and it's saving fish from drowning, and is what Buddhist fishermen say, because they're not supposed to kill anything, and they also have to make a living, and people need to be fed. So their way of rationalizing that is they are saving the fish from drowning, and unfortunately in the process the fish die. Now what's encapsulated in both these drowning metaphors, actually one of them is my mother's interpretation, and it is a famous Chinese saying because she said it to me, save a man from drowning, you're responsible to him for life, and it was a warning, don't get involved in other people's business or you're going to get stuck. Okay, I think if somebody really was drowning, she'd save them. But both of these things, saving a fish from drowning or saving a man from drowning, to me they had to do with intentions. And all of us in life, when we see a situation, we have a response, and then we have intentions, or there's an ambiguity of what that should be that we should do, and then we do something, and the results of that may not match what our intentions had be. Maybe things go wrong. And so after that, what are our responsibilities? What are we supposed to do? Do we stay in for life, or do we do something else and justify and say, well, my intentions were good, and therefore it cannot be held responsible for all of it. That is the ambiguity in my life that really disturbed me and led me to write a book called Saving Fish from Drowning. I saw examples of that. Once I identified this question, it was all over the place. I got these hints everywhere. And then, in a way, I knew that they had always been there. And then writing, that's what happens. I get these hints, these clues, and I realize that they've been hard. They've been obvious, and yet they have not been. And what I need, in effect, is a focus. When I have the question, it is a focus, and all these things that seem to be flotsam and jetsam in life actually go through that question, and what happens is those particular things become relevant, and it seems like it's happening all the time. You think there's a sort of coincidence going on, a serendipity, in which you're getting all this help from the universe, and it may also be explained that now you have a focus, and you are noticing it more often. But you apply this, you begin to look at things having to do with your tensions, your brother who's fallen into trouble, do you take care of him, why or why not? It may be something that is perhaps more serious, as I said, human rights in Burma. I was thinking that I shouldn't go because somebody said if I did it would show that I approved of the military regime there. And then after a while I had to ask myself, why do we take on knowledge? Why do we take on assumptions that other people have given us? And it was the same thing that I felt when I was growing up and was hearing these rules and of moral conduct from my father, who was a Baptist minister. So I decided that I would go to Burma for my own intentions, and still didn't know that if I went there, what the result of that would be if I wrote a book. And I just would have to face that later when the time came. We are all concerned with things that we see in the world that we are aware of. We come to this point and say, what do I as an individual do? Not all of us can go to Africa or work at hospitals. So what do we do if we have this moral response, this feeling also, I think one of the biggest things we were all looking at and we talked about today is genocide. This leads to this question, when I look at all these things that are morally ambiguous and uncomfortable, and I consider what my intention should be, I realize it goes back to this identity question that I had when I was a child, and why am I here, and what is the meaning of my life, and what is my place in the universe? It seems so obvious, and yet it is not. We all hate moral ambiguity in some sense, and yet it is also absolutely necessary in writing a story. It is the place where I begin. Sometimes I get help from the universe, it seems. My mother would say it was the ghost of my grandmother from the very first book, because it seemed I knew things I was not supposed to know. Instead of writing that the grandmother died accidentally from an overdose of opium while having too much of a good time, I actually put down in the story that the woman killed herself, and that actually was the way it happened. And my mother decided that that information must have come from my grandmother. There are also things quite uncanny which bring me information that will help me in the writing of the book. In this case, I was writing a story that included some kind of detail, period of history, a certain location, and I needed to find something historically that would match that. And I took down this book, and I first page that I flipped it to was exactly the setting and the time period and the kind of character I needed. It was the Taiping Rebellion happening in the area near Guilin, outside of that, and a character who thought he was the Son of God. You wonder, are these things random chance? Well, what is random? What is chance? What is luck? What are things that you get from the universe that you can't really explain? And that goes into the story, too. These are the things I constantly think about from day to day, especially when good things happen, and in particular, when bad things happen. But I do think there's a kind of serendipity, and I do want to know what those elements are so I can thank them and also try to find them in my life. Because, again, I think that when I am aware of them, more of them happen. Another chance encounter is when I went to a place. I just was with some friends, and we drove randomly to a different place, and we ended up in this non-tourist location, a beautiful village, pristine, and we walked three valleys beyond. In the third valley, there was something quite mysterious and ominous, a discomfort I felt, and then I knew that had to be the setting of my book. And in writing one of the scenes, it happened in that third valley. For some reason, I wrote about cairns, stacks of rocks that a man was building. And I didn't know exactly why I had it, but it was so vivid. I got stuck, and a friend, when she asked if I would go for a walk with her dogs, that I said, sure. And about 45 minutes later, walking along the beach, I came across this. And it was a man, a Chinese man, and he was stacking these things, not with glue, not with anything. And I asked him, how is it possible to do this? And he said, well, I guess with everything in life, there's a place of balance. And this was exactly the meaning of my story at that point. I had so many examples, I have so many instances like this when I'm writing a story, and I cannot explain it. Is it because I had the filter that I have such a strong coincidence in writing about these things? Or is it a kind of serendipity that we cannot explain, like the cosmological constant? A big thing that I also think about is accidents. And as I said, my mother did not believe in randomness. What is the nature of accidents? And how are we going to assign what the responsibility and the causes are outside of a court of law? I was able to see that in a first-hand way when I went to a beautiful Dong village in Guizhou, in the poorest province of China. And I saw this beautiful place. I knew I wanted to come back. And I had a chance to do that when National Geographic asked me if I wanted to write anything about China. They said, yes, about this village of singing people, singing minority. And they agreed. And between the time I saw this place and the next time I went, there was a terrible accident. A man, an old man, fell asleep and his quilt dropped in a pan of fire that kept him warm. 60 homes were destroyed and 40 were damaged. Responsibility was assigned to the family. The man's sons were banished to live 3 kilometers away in a cow shed. And, of course, as Westerners, we say, well, it was an accident. That's not fair. It's the son, not the father. And when I go on the story, I have to let go of those kinds of beliefs. It takes a while, but I have to let go of them and just go there and be there. And so I was there on three occasions, different seasons. And I began to sense something different about the history and what had happened before and the nature of life in a very poor village and what you find is your joys and your rituals, your traditions, your links with other families. And I saw how this had a kind of justice and its responsibility. I was able to find out also about the ceremony that they were using, that a ceremony they hadn't used in about 29 years, and it was to send some men, a feng shui master, sent men down to the underworld on ghost horses. Now you as Westerners and I as Westerners would say, well, that's superstition. But after being there for a while and seeing the amazing things that happen, you begin to wonder whose beliefs are those that are in operation in the world determining how things happen. So I remained with them, and the more I wrote that story, the more I got into those beliefs, and I think that's important for me to take on the beliefs, because that is where the story is real, and that is where I'm going to find the answers to how I feel about certain questions that I have in life. Years go by, of course, in the writing. It doesn't happen instantly as it. I'm trying to convey it to you here on at TED. The book comes and it goes. When it arrives, it is no longer my book. It is in the hands of readers and they interpret it differently. But I go back to this question of how do I create something out of nothing? And how do I create my own life? And I think it is by questioning and saying to myself that there are no absolute truths. I believe in specifics, the specifics of story and the past, the specifics of that past and what is happening in the story at that point. I also believe that in thinking about things, my thinking about luck and fate and coincidences and accidents, God's will and the synchrony of mysterious forces, I will come to some notion of what that is, how we create. I have to think of my role, where I am in the universe, and did somebody intend for me to be that way, or was it just something I came up with? And I also can find that by imagining fully and becoming what is imagined and yet is in that real world, the fictional world. And that is how I find particles of truth, not the absolute truth or the whole truth. And they have to be in all possibilities, including those I never considered before. So there are never complete answers. Or rather, if there is an answer, it is to remind myself that there is uncertainty in everything, and that is good, because then I will discover something new. And if there is a partial answer, a more complete answer for me, it is to simply imagine. And to imagine is to put myself in that story until there is a transparency between me and the story that I am creating. And that's how I've discovered that if I feel what is in the story, in one story, then I come the closest, I think, to knowing what compassion is, to feeling that compassion. Because for everything in that question of how things happen, it has to do with the feeling. I have to become the story in order to understand a lot of that. We've come to the end of the talk, and I will reveal what is in the bag. And it is the muse, and it is the things that transform in our lives that are wonderful and stay with us.
这个演讲者确实具有一定的迷惑性，但我觉得像这种就是亚洲脸，英文说的特利落的人很多，但是像那种西方脸但中文说的很利落的人比较少。不过最近我们就来了一个实习生，她是一个就纯白人小女孩，但是人家中文说的简直就是比我还地道的京片子吧，那种感觉就是经常让人非常的恍惚
啊，
闭着
眼睛一
听，
反正
一家
也听
出来，她就是特别特别地道的北京话。哎呀，秘密分享够了，我们下期节目
再
见。Just people watching the other people. 下一期大学生英语在线将继续为您带来 TED Talk 的内容。
接下来您将听到的是私房拷贝。 Coming up next is home video。
Dream of power.